Hi there. Welcome to Afternoon Magazine. My name is Philip Graham, and I'm guest hosting today for Celeste Quinn. Today I'll be speaking with one of my very, very favorite writers, Margot Livesey, and we'll be talking about her new novel, Eva Moves the Furniture. Before we get started, I'd like to let everybody out there know that if you'd like to talk with Margot about anything about this novel or other parts of her work, you can call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Hi, Margot, you there?
I am, Philip, with great pleasure.
we're going to have some fun today, I hope, okay?
We certainly are.
I love this novel. I love all your work, but and I really love this novel. It's a ghost story, or you could see it as a ghost story, and I'll just describe a little bit about the book for the people out there if they're not familiar with it. It's the story of a young woman named Eva who, when she is born, her mother dies during that childbirth, and she is raised by her father David and her aunt Lily, who's her father's sister. And Barbara, the mother, is very, very much missed by this family, including by Eva, who has, of course, never really met her. And during her childhood, a loved but lonely childhood in many ways, she finds herself being visited by two people she calls the companions. It's an older woman and a young girl, and she quickly begins to realize that she's the only one who can see them. They seem to want to protect her, but at other times it appears that they want to harm her. And in either case, they really seem to have an effect on her life in ways that she simply can't predict. And a lot of the drama of this novel, for me at least, is who are these people? Are they really ghosts? And also, what do they want from poor Eva? And though in many ways this is a novel that's quiet and beautifully written, it also really gets under your skin. It's eerie and at times really quite frightening, but also quite beautiful. Yeah, how'd I do?
You did superbly, Philip.
Oh, thanks.
It's important to add that Eva is born in 1920
yes.
in the lowlands of Scotland, outside a little town called Troon. So she's very much born in the shadow of the First World War and, of course, finds herself growing up into the Second World War.
Yeah.
And her life is very marked by both those wars.
Yes. I should have remembered that because my father was born in Glasgow. So one of the things I love about this book is by seeing that world, which is, you know, a world that he would have grown up in, too. He was born in 1919.
Yes. You had told me that, and I had forgotten.
Oh, how can you forget that? We're both Scots.
Under the skin.
Yeah. Now, one thing, that you were in town here last year, and you gave a wonderful reading from your novel, The Missing World. And while you were here, you mentioned to me, because I think you were just doing some final copy editing on Eva Moves the Furniture, that this is a novel that had taken you 12 years to write. Now, in that time, you published a number of novels, I think three altogether, but Eva did have to wait in line, and I thought maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that whole process.
Yes. At the beginning of Eva Moves the Furniture, they don't have a cradle for the baby, and so they put her in a drawer, and I think I did that because for many years I kept the novel in a drawer. I began it in 1986 or 87 after my guardian, Roger, told me a story about my mother, Eva. And that story was about the real Eva's relationship with the supernatural. And it stayed with me. And I thought, oh, that is so amazing. I will try to write a novel about this.
Yeah.
And really, to make a long history short, I tried and felt that it wasn't working and stopped and wrote my first novel. I tried and felt that it wasn't working and stopped and wrote my second novel and so on. And I think it wasn't until I'd written my third novel that I finally knew what to do with Eva Moves the Furniture.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned that the character Eva is in some sense based upon your mother. What parts were based on the stories that you were told about her, and also what parts were invented? Or do you want to talk about how that works in terms of invention and storytelling and what's received and what you make up?
Well, one of the biggest obstacles for my writing, to my writing Eva Moves the Furniture, was how little I knew about my mother and how hard it was to find out more about her. By the time I started to ask questions and take an interest in her, most of the people who knew her had died or moved away. And because she died when I was 2 and a half, I have no memory, no verbal cognizant memories of her. So one of the hard things was being really prepared to invent my mother. But I did try to include in the novel as many of the things that I knew about her as I could. So, for instance, I had a little medal that my mother, Eva, had won for high jumping in 1936 at her girls' school. Mm-hmm. So I made my character, Eva, take up high jumping.
That's right. There's that scene, and the ghosts help her cheat a little bit, too,
exactly,
if I remember.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was nice of you to do that for your mom.
Yeah, she got a little extra levitation from the ghosts.
Yeah.
But Eva was herself a nurse, and that was very, obviously, very central to the novel. And she was, as a nurse, she ran the sanatorium at the boys' school where I grew up until she married my father. This was the time when women quit their jobs after marriage. And one of the most common complaints among her patients was that while Eva was lovely, it was very hard to get a good night's sleep in the sanatorium because the furniture was always banging and thudding around.
Oh, so that's where some of the movement of the furniture comes
from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, I like how you did that. Yeah. Very nice. Now, you know, getting a little personal on my side, my mother's father died when she was 3 years old, and I know part of what she carried into her childhood and adult life was the sadness that, in fact, there were no photographs of her father. Are there photographs of you with your mother, and did you use anything like that, any visual cues like that in beginning some inspiration?
That's a wonderful question, because I had a very sort of misty studio photograph of my mother that hung over my bed after my father remarried. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I was maybe 35 that I finally saw a photograph of the two of us together. And, of course, it seemed hugely significant to me when I did see that.
Yes.
And then I have a few snapshots of my mother with my father.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny, you use those sorts of things, and you can take a look, I suppose, at that photograph and make up an entire story, even though you can't remember necessarily when that picture was taken with your mother and yourself. But I was thinking about, you know, having to sort of reinvent your mother, as you mentioned. I mean, it's in some ways, you know, it's terrible, you know, to lose a parent so young. And yet it seems to me that even if your parents are with you all your life, you're constantly inventing and then reinventing you. I know from my own sense, I'm constantly having to reevaluate what my parents were like as I get older and learn a little bit more about life. Here you get to see Eva throughout her life, and that reinvention is something, again, that comes back down to all that you could wish or want of her, not that it's sort of mediated by things you actually know about her.
And I think that was really I think there were several large obstacles to writing this novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one was how to make such personal information publicly interesting. After all, everyone has a mother of their own, so why should they want to hear about my mother? And another was, I think, for me, accepting that I actually did have a mother. I think in some odd way I thought of myself as motherless. And it wasn't really until my friends started having children and I saw the relationship between mother and small child that I began to have some feeling, some insight into what a large part Eva had played in my life, even if she was only around for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. That's right. One of the wonderful things about being a parent is you get to see those first 3 years of your life that you cannot remember, you know?
Yes.
And the interesting thing for me, though, is I've known you for, 15, 16 years now. I did not, as I read Eva Moves the Furniture, I was not thinking that Eva was your mother, even though I sort of know a good bit about your past life. I just read Eva as Eva. She was, for me, an entirely fictional character, and it wasn't until I read weeks maybe later after I finished the novel, some of those more personal connections. So, you know, I didn't feel like I was reading your mom. I felt like I was reading Eva, and I really cared a lot for this character.
Well, I'm very glad to have you say that, because I think part of the ambition was to give life to my mother, to give this woman who had too short a life and who so many people no longer remembered, a small place on the planet again.
Yeah. Well, you know, to follow that through, I'll have to say also that as I was reading it, at times I found myself thinking, this reminds me a little of Margot. You know, and at the time I was thinking, well, of course, Margot wrote this book. Of course, she would be putting parts of herself into this character. But in a sense, now what I'm thinking about is you're writing about your mother, and in some ways, she seems to me at various points like you. And of course, you know, we are like our parents, or maybe our parents are like us. You know,
I think I did give Eva certain qualities in common with me, and I say at the beginning of the novel, I make a kind of apologia for this. I say something like, some parts of this story are true in one way and some in another.
Yes.
And Eva talks about sort of how she came to give us her story.
Yeah.
And I went through, I think, a similar process. I mean, both the process of learning how to write this novel in technical terms and learning about both childhood and motherhood by watching my friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also, I think, gave Eva my loneliness. I mean, I think the novel has a kind of yearning about it.
Yeah.
That speaks, I think, to many people. I mean, certainly people who've responded to the book. I mean, many of them have had both the good fortune to have both parents, mm-hmm. but still have known this kind of loneliness of childhood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can still have both your parents and feel awfully lonely as your child. Again, so that in a sense, you know, it transcends your the autobiography and the autobiographical impulse of the fiction, because there are very universal feelings in this wonderful novel. Now, you were talking about sort of the learning how to write this technically, and I found it very interesting how you presented the companions. Now, one of the things I liked about the companions, or if you want to say the ghosts, is that both you and I have written ghost stories.
And I was very conscious of you looking over my shoulder at certain points.
I'm so sorry. But I wouldn't have done that. But the thing I love about the possibilities of writing about the afterlife, and I really enjoyed the way you presented what can be seen as visitations from the afterlife, is that it really can be anything. There's no one's going to come back from the dead and say, you got that wrong. You know, that's not what it's like, you know, after you die. And so you have an amazing amount of freedom in order to present that afterlife. But that's also the other side of that, is that there's so much freedom that you almost don't know what to do with it.
Yes. And I think for the most part, with some shining exceptions like yourself, contemporary sort of mainstream writing in America and Britain at this time does not offer very good role models for writing about that level of reality we call the supernatural.
Yeah.
I found myself mostly going to other cultures, to Scottish folklore, Judaic folklore, Native American, Latin American magic realism, to see, well, how could you write about this kind of peculiar place where one world meets another.
Yes. Well, I have to say, from my own experience, it came from, you know, living in African villages for a number of years while my wife was doing her research, and living among people who believed invisible people were always around them. And I've also read that you have some things to say about the magic that's in the culture of Scotland, where you did grow up. And I'd love it if you could talk at some length about that for everybody out there, and also for me, because though my father was born in Scotland, in Glasgow, I've never been there, and it's someplace I really, really want to go. So any way you can fill me in, that would be just marvelous.
Well, I grew up, as you know, Philip, in the rather peculiar environment of a boys' private school on the edge of the Scottish Highlands. So,
yeah.
I mean, my landscape was full of boys in kilts and but
is that so bad, Margot?
Just dreadful. But we were 10 miles from the nearest town, and people did not drive casually during my childhood. So it was quite an isolated community. And that community was marked by a number of things. On the one hand, the landscape was marked. So, for instance, there was a Roman fort nearby that had been built by one of the Roman legions that came that far north in Scotland. There were old drove roads that had been used to take the cattle down from the highlands to the lowlands, marking the hills. There was set the grave of the legendary 9th century Scottish poet Ossian was said to be nearby, though whether Ossian or his grave ever existed is quite controversial.
Yeah.
So there was a kind of mythical history buried in the landscape. And then there were also stories that that people talked about as if they were true. So, for instance, there was a nearby village called Camsoni, and the rumor about Camsoni was that when no one was around, the village disappeared. And I would say, well, what happens to the villagers? Mm-hmm. And people would say, well, they disappear too. And I'd say, well, don't they mind that? You know, I could never get to the bottom of this as a child. It seemed very perplexing. And there were also stories, and I put one in Eva Moves the Furniture, about a dairy maid who drowned and who was said to walk at harvest time.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this was reported not as so much as a supernatural occurrence, but perhaps like in your African village, Philip, as a quite everyday occurrence.
And isn't that the marvelous thing about that? I mean, here, if you were to say something about, I saw a ghost or this happened, people would start to look at you out of the corner of their eye and start to whisper behind your back. But in those cultures where the invisible has real possibility, real reality, that, it's an alternate way of looking at the world, whether it's true or not, that is, it opens up more possibilities for the human imagination, it seems to me.
Yes, I mean, I would completely agree with that. And I think one of the pleasures of writing this novel and having it published has been discovering that there are many people who do feel as we do, and that, you know, they have everyone has a kind of schizophrenic vision of the supernatural. So on the one hand, they have a small body of stories that they believe in.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, they have many sort of National Enquirer kind of stories that they're quite skeptical about.
Well, it's good to be skeptical of the National Enquirer.
Yes.
Margot, there's so much wonderful writing in here, and I have, when we've talked about this earlier, picked out a couple scenes that I would love if you could read from. The one that, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to hear, and also the people out there in the audience, is that scene where Eva is having a sort of a play date with a young woman named Catherine, and she's her first friend almost, and somehow one of the companions seems to arrive in the middle of that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
And I would love to read this. And I think you can feel, even in these few paragraphs, some of Eva's dilemma and some of her loneliness.
Yeah.
At tea, Mrs. Grant made me sit on her right and insisted on serving me first. She asked about Lily and David, what was happening at the Women's Institute, whether David's office was busy. Across the table, Catherine asked questions of her own. Did I ever ride Mr. Wright's cart horse? No. If I could visit any country I liked, where would it be? The Congo. To my surprise, there was no cake. Indeed, neither Catherine nor her grandmother mentioned her birthday. Could I have misunderstood? When tea was over, Catherine took me, not to her bedroom, but to the back garden. After the rambling sprawl of Ballantyre is Eva's home, the square of paving stone surrounded by straggly flower beds seemed pitifully small. The only object of interest was a bird bath standing in the middle of the square. Catherine lifted a twig out of the bowl. It was almost full of water from the recent rain. "What shall we do?" she said. It's hard to play games with just two. I have a friend. I watched her pale hands moving over the bowl. Maybe we could... A loud splash finished my sentence. Catherine screamed. I leapt forward. In the bowl lay a stone the size of an apple. Raising my eyes, I saw the girl sitting on the wall at the end of the garden. Beneath her hard stare, the distance shrank until I could have counted the freckles on her nose, 8 of them, and the loose hairs pulling out of her braids. She stuck out her tongue and slid down the far side of the wall. "Cripes," muttered Catherine. Had she seen the girl, I wondered, but she was wiping her face with the skirt of her green dress. "Are you hurt?" I asked. "Stupid. Why did you do that?" Her hair was dripping and her bodice patterned with dark stains. "I didn't do anything." Instinctively, I stepped back. "It's only water. I'll get a towel." She pointed to the stone. "I suppose a ghost threw this?" The following year, when my friend Isabel taught me hockey, she often chided me for procrastination. "You have to tackle the minute they get the ball, not wait for a better chance." That afternoon, in Catherine's garden, I recognized my chance and was afraid. My earlier fantasies had fled. All I could imagine was her calling me daft, or worse. Speechless, I gazed at the incriminating stone.
Wow. Well, that's beautiful. I think it also, thank you, Margot, gives a wonderful sense of the dilemma that poor Eva feels, because, you know, she does have these companions and they're there. And so in some sense, she is never alone. But on the other hand, they seem not to like her to spend too much time with others. And so they become both a constant companionship and also a form of deep isolation for Eva. And that's one of the dramas of the story. And it's really terrifying to watch that work its way out in some ways, because also there is a point where you're never quite certain if Eva herself has imagined these companions because she's so lonely, because she has lost her mother, and yet at the same time her mother is a kind of presence in this family because she's always spoken of.
Yes, I mean, Barbara is sort of the third companion, sometimes more present than others, but never entirely absent. And I think, I mean, I hope that the novel finally answers the questions as to who are the companions by making it sort of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly didn't begin the novel thinking of them as a manifestation of psychological disturbance or some sort of hallucination. Yeah. And that's why, for instance, in the passage I just read, I give the girl 8 freckles, for instance.
That's right. Couldn't make that up, right?
Yes, my ghosts are very down to earth.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not ethereal. You can't really see through them. They're absolutely there, and they're very substantial, and they have effect on the world, but no one else can see them.
Yeah, and when I tried to think of analogies for it, I thought, really, for Eva, it's like being able to see extra colors or hear extra notes of music in the way that dogs and small children can hear very high notes.
Yeah.
I think of her as having
nice,
a sort of larger than usual sensory vocabulary.
Yes. Oh, I like that very much. I have to sort of segue for a second, Margot, and remind everybody that this is the Afternoon Magazine, and I am speaking with you, Margot Livesey, the author of your most recent novel, Eva Moves the Furniture, and that if there are people out there who would like to speak with the author, we have two phone lines where you could call locally. It's 333-9455, and if you're out of the area or you just want to save a nickel or something, it's 1-800-222-9455. Back again now to Margot Livesey. One of the things about this book, which seems, which I like so much, was a pattern in it that reminded me of other books of yours. Again, this kind of either or. Are these companions there to help her, or are they there to harm her? And it reminded me of your first novel, though I must say I always like thinking of Learning by Heart as your first novel, but I've seen Homework referred to as your first novel, so I'll go with that. Homework, in which there is a woman named Cecilia who is married, a widower, and moves in with him and his young daughter, Jenny. And it's a marvelous novel that kind of turns around the notion of the evil stepmother, because this seems to be a novel, perhaps, about the evil stepdaughter. And is this daughter doing terrible things to Cecilia because she wants to get rid of her stepdaughter? And again, there's that sense of, is it or is it not happening? Cecilia is never quite sure if she's being unfair to her new stepdaughter or not. And that, in a sense, reminded me a little bit of what Eva is worrying about with the companions.
Yes, I think, for some people, I think Eva seemed like a huge departure from my earlier work because it's preoccupied with women and children, mothers and daughters. Excuse me. And because it's set in the past rather than addressing contemporary issues. But for me, it was very much a continuation of earlier work in that Eva, like earlier characters, sort of stands at an odd angle to the universe and has to think about whether her way of seeing the world is appropriate or correct.
Well, don't we all worry about that, Margot?
well, I hope we do. I think we all ought to, but I'm not sure we all do. And one of the questions for the narrator of my novel Homework is she's just never quite sure if she's seeing her stepdaughter correctly. Could this little girl possibly be doing these ghastly things?
Right.
Might they just be genuine mistakes or accidents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's even a fire, I think, at one point, if I remember correctly.
Yes, it sort of ends in a conflagration.
Yes.
I thought, I'll burn the house down.
go out with a bang, right? Yeah. Another book that it reminds me of is The Missing World. And the thing about The Missing World is there's a young woman whose name is Hazel, and she has had an accident. I think a car bumps into her when she's on a bike, and she doesn't really hurt herself very badly, except that she lands on her head, and it causes her to have a kind of selective amnesia. I think she can't remember the last 3 years of her life.
Exactly.
And into that, you know, empty space moves her her ex-fiancé, Jonathan, who is a rather unscrupulous sort of lover who wants to pretend that they never broke up. He realizes that she can't remember why they broke up, and she becomes a kind of a prisoner in the house they used to live in. And I think the dilemma again for Helen is, you know, she can't remember those last 3 years, but she's not quite sure that the kind of line that Jonathan is giving her is the correct one. There is still a part of herself deep down inside that's screaming, no, that's not the way it is.
That's a very good way of describing Hazel's situation. And I think in the light of Eva Moves the Furniture, although I wouldn't have quite known this at the time, that I was writing my way towards knowing how to finish Eva Moves the Furniture in The Missing World, because I was part of what I try to do in that novel is figure out my attitudes to memory. And I finally end up saying, well, there are other kinds of memories that are really important besides the ones we can give voice to. And there are different ways of remembering things. You can remember things in the body, not just in the brain.
Yeah. I really like that, Margot. I've never heard anybody say anything like that before. The Missing World is indeed its own wonderful and complete novel. But when you say that, in a sense, you were writing towards a way of learning how to write another novel, you know, that's enormously true. But I don't think very many people talk about that, is that, you know, works of art, in this case these novels, are not really discrete works. They're part of a continuing imagination and a continuing arc of an individual writer's inspiration, not only for that particular work, but maybe other works to come.
And I think you can see that very much. I can see that very much when I look at your work, Philip.
Oh, well, thank you.
How the stories have fed the novels and the novels the stories, and how the African side of your life has fed the American side of your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we all have our secret currents that, you know, again, we can only elucidate, that aren't necessarily there for the reader to understand. But it makes me now curious as to what is there, Margot dear, in Eva Moves the Furniture that is moving towards your next novel. And could you have any, people usually don't like to talk about their next novel, so you can just completely ignore that, but or in any detail anyway, but do you see anything in this novel that took so long for you to write and is, I think, so beautiful and successful that might be calling towards a new future work?
I'm hoping that I'm going to write a novel. Eva Moves the Furniture echoes one part of my own life history, and I hope I'm going to write a novel that echoes another part of my life history, namely what it's like to live between two countries.
Uh-huh.
Having grown up in Scotland and gone to university in England, I now spend most of my adult life in America. But I still spend a lot of time thinking about Britain and visiting mm-hmm. when I can.
Yes.
So it remains very much a part of my mental and spiritual life.
Yeah.
And I'd like to write a novel that somehow measures and reflects what it's like to live between two countries, which I think makes me kind of Jamesian in my concerns.
Though perhaps in the other direction.
Yes, exactly. I'd like to write sort of Isabel Archer comes to America rather than goes
right,
to Europe.
Right, right. But there was, again, there's that either-or quality that you see in The Turn of the Screw and that you see in a lot of your own work, that is it or isn't it, you know? And there you are in your position of being in the middle, in a sense, between two cultures. You can see where that sort of ground level of background reality fits itself into the lives of your characters.
Yes, and I don't mean to suggest that, I mean, I do think of setting as being a very intrinsic part
yeah.
of my work.
Yeah.
So bringing my characters or bringing my imagination to America is not something I do lightly. It's, I think, going to take deep thought and deep effort to do it.
Yes, of course, as it always does. Oh, novels are so hard to write. Now, Margot, I haven't really talked, and forgive me for this, about so many other aspects of this novel. We've been sort of talking a lot about the ghostly or spiritual qualities of it, but then there's also a really, really fascinating part of this book, and that is when Eva grows up and she becomes a nurse and she finds herself working during the darkest days of World War II and working in a ward that is trying to help people who have had terrible, terrible disfigurements from the bombings in London and elsewhere, and working on them in terms of plastic surgery. And maybe we could talk about a little bit more about that, and also maybe the nature of research too, since I know you must have done research, and I love doing that myself, and maybe we could have some fun talking about that. But there is a lovely scene in which you have Eva coming upon someone who is on his... in his last breaths. Do you remember that passage?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
and in fact, this is Eva at Glasgow Infirmary, and it's her first night of night duty, and she's quite apprehensive about it because when you're on night duty, you have many more responsibilities, and there are far fewer superiors to share those responsibilities.
Yeah.
I arrived on duty at 9 p.m., heavy-headed, and was sent to men's surgical. Just my luck, muttered the staff nurse on hearing that this was my first night. The two of us had 27 men in our care. Her strong Glasgow accent was not unlike my friend Daphne's, but she herself showed no trace of Daphne's kindness and humour. During the next few hours, as she chivied me from task to task, her forehead never once unfurrowed, even when a drunk brought in at closing time with a broken ankle burst into a lusty version of, Donald, where's your tutors? Forgive me for not singing that. Finally, at 1 o'clock, with everything more or less under control, she announced she was going to dinner. Watch the drip on number 11, she said, handing me the keys to the dangerous drugs cupboard. Bed number 4 is in trouble. She marched away, and in the wake of her departure, one of those odd silences fell, when, for a few minutes, no one was snoring or groaning or crying out, and from behind the drawn screens of number 4, which I had passed 100 times that evening, I heard tiny, mouse-like gasps. In all my thoughts of nursing, strange to say, it had never once occurred to me that some patients failed to recover. Even performing last offices on the pink and white dummy we used for bandages and injections had failed to prepare me. Now I stood beside the flimsy screens, listening intently, until some mixture of pride and compassion forced me inside. In the glow of the nightlight, a slender man lay propped on several pillows, head lolling, eyes closed. I was struck by the ordinariness of his striped pajamas, similar to my father's, and then by how youthful his face was, in spite of grey hair. As he stammered from one breath to the next, I clasped my hands and counted, like I used to do between the flash of lightning and the peal of thunder, as if the interval would reveal some crucial distance. I was reaching hesitantly for his pulse, a wholly useless gesture I was terrified to make, when from a nearby bed a voice whispered, "Bedpan, nurse." By the time I returned, he was gone. I don't know for how long I remained, counting into the hundreds, hoping for one more gasp, before I heard the staff nurse's footsteps. "He died," I told her. "Number 4. I couldn't stop him." At my babble, her frown intensified. She held out her hand, not in comfort, but for the keys. "Pull yourself together, Nurse McEwen. Off you go to dinner and pick up a shroud on your way back." A shroud, I thought. Where on earth would I find that in the middle of the night? But when I asked, the porter took me to a room lined floor to ceiling with neatly folded garments. "Adult?" he demanded. "Small, medium, or large?" And suddenly I understood that the other great business of the infirmary, besides helping the sick to return to the world, was helping them to leave it. Yet how seldom anyone spoke of this. Only Father Wishart and Samuel acknowledged our role as watchers at that perilous threshold. Samuel told me that the first time a patient died on the operating table, he had sliced into the chest cavity and begun to massage the heart by hand, shouting for the man to come back. "I couldn't believe there was nothing to be done," he said. "The anaesthetist had to pull me away." Walking back to the ward, carrying the flimsy shroud through the darkened corridors, I thought of Barbara. I was glad she had died at home with people who knew her name, who were not afraid to take her hand.
Oh, boy, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. I know that you, one of the things that helped you in writing this novel was when you, I think, came upon a book about the plastic surgery efforts during the Second World War, and you realized maybe, perhaps right away, that this was another window that would help you into this novel?
Yes, I wanted to write about the Second World War and about Eva's nursing, but I was very stuck as to what angle to come at that material from. And one day on the Charing Cross Road in London in a second-hand bookshop, I came upon a biography of a wonderful pioneering plastic surgeon. He would have called himself a reconstructive surgeon, called Archie McIndoe. And in reading that book, I discovered that prior to the Second World War, there had only been 3 or 4 people in the whole of Britain who were practicing plastic surgery. And then suddenly, with the combination of the Blitz and the Battle of Britain, there were hundreds and hundreds of burn victims, and there was a terrible need for reconstructive surgery. And this surgeon, Archie McIndoe, ran a pioneering burns unit outside of London, and was very radical in his techniques. And also, many of his patients were pilots burned in the Battle of Britain, and they were aged 19 or 20. And they were very well-educated young men who went on to form a club called the Guinea Pig Club.
Oh, God.
they knew they were pioneers in plastic surgery, and there are wonderful photographs of meetings of the Guinea Pig Club, which are basically men in suits, all of whom look normal the first time you look and very strange the second.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Many of them left wonderful accounts of their treatment. And,
yeah.
So as soon as I read this material, which was fascinating in itself, I thought, oh, what a wonderful metaphor for Eva's dilemma of the way she doesn't know how to read reality and the sort of gap between appearance and reality for her.
Yeah.
Because many of these men have had their faces obliterated, which is really one of the first ways we normally respond to people.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Now, I remember... when I was going to writers' colonies like Yaddo and McDowell, there would always be someone who would be writing an historical novel or have a novel that had some kind of historical background, and they always told the same story, no matter who they were or when I talked to them, and it was always that they would do their research and then they would end up writing an 800-page novel, only 400 pages of which were novel, and the other 400 were all the wonderful little tidbits of research that they had learned that they had to then cut out in order to have the story come alive. And I know that whenever I've done that research for the work that I do, I'm always, you know, there's that fine balance of you fall in love with certain things and you really want to put it in the story, but at the same time you have to be careful about that. But then there's the worry of, am I putting enough in? You maybe want to talk about the feelings that you had as you were doing that research.
my research was actually my own memories, because growing up in the 1950s, the late 50s, I should hastily add, my childhood was not probably so different from either my mother Eva's or my character Eva's. We didn't have a phone or a fridge or a telephone until I was 8 or 9. And people didn't drive casually. If you got a parcel, you unwrapped it very carefully so that you could reuse the paper and the string. It was a very, very thrifty time. So part of it was just thinking about my early life, and part of the research was talking to people close to. Eva's age would have been.
I was thinking specifically, though, of the burn victims that you were mentioning before, in terms of, you know, you probably came across a huge number of stories that you'd love to kind of fit in or shoehorn in the narrative, and yet, again, where did you decide what to do with that knowledge and elaborate into Eva's story without it overwhelming Eva's story?
Yes, well, of course, I did have that traditional problem, and I think... I mean, when I moved house last year, I should say that I happily recycled 8 completely different versions of the novel and sent a check to the rainforest. So I certainly threw out hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. And many of those probably were, you know, bad versions of research. And I think finally I wanted, it's kind of lofty ambition, which I'm sure I can't accomplish. I wanted every sentence of the novel to feel necessary. I didn't want to feel I was wasting my reader's time. And so finally I compressed a novel that covers, you know, 27, 28 years into just a little over, 200 pages? I wanted it to be as swiftly moving as possible, as necessary as possible.
Yes. Thank you, by the way, for saying that you sent a check to the rainforest. Now I know how to assuage my guilt at the end of every book I write. You know?
Well, I've got into this with my creative writing classes. I try to persuade all the students to make donations.
I think that is the greatest thing. You know, I'm going to do that from now on. God, you've just lifted a burden from my heart. You have no idea.
Oh, good.
Now, if with your permission, there's a section of your novel that I would like to read, if that's okay.
That would be wonderful.
Okay, thank you. I'm not trying to compete or anything, but I just love the prose. And there's a part here, and it does relate in some sense to the title of the book. And I'll be very delicate about this because I don't want to give anything away. But it's actually early on, and Eva is walking with her father, and her father has, you know, told her, has always been telling her stories about her mother, and here she hears something a little different. They're coming back from Barbara's grave. As I tidied the grave, my father recounted a dream he'd had, something about the Hanscoms, but I was too excited to listen. I was picturing myself in a suit taking dictation, perhaps even speaking on the telephone, because she's going to have a job soon. When he was satisfied, he nodded farewell. She was a lovely woman, Mrs. Hanscom, he said at the gate. I would never have married Barbara without her help. How do you mean? I said, paying attention at last. You fell in love at the optician's. I did, but Barbara took a little longer. Mrs. Hanscom gave us a chance to get acquainted by asking us to tea every Sunday. Speaking of tea, wasn't there something Lily wanted? And we halted, each struggling to recall Lily's request. We were both quiet on the walk to the co-op. Perhaps my father was preoccupied with his dream. As for me, I was glimpsing that the stories I'd been hearing all my life had been changed in the telling, made into fairy tales for a little girl. Now I have some understanding of why one might want to protect the child, but at the time it gave me an unsettling feeling. Were the facts I had taken for granted going to start shifting like the furniture? Yes, of course, the whole world was shifting, and an unsettled feeling lasted on and off for years. And there is that quality of the shifting of the furniture, whether it's the real shifting of the furniture that the companions seem to be doing at times, or the sort of the interior shifting of the furniture that Eva is often doing, and that the companions sort of make her do, is to sort of look at the world and try to figure out what needs to be seen and how it should be seen. It's just a beautiful book.
Thank you, Philip. It's very touching to hear you read that.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's a privilege to hear one's words, someone else's voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I really hate to say this, but we have to go. Now
oh,
I understand.
No.
Yeah, I know. We should have another hour. Let's just, to hell with everything else. Let's just do what we want, you know? But actually, we really have to go. So, Margot, thank you very much. I love talking with you. I hope we'll be able to do this again sometime. And so thank you very much. And
Thank you, Philip. And,
okay.
It's wonderful to feel so understood and my novel so
okay.
much to heart.
Thank you for the wonderful work.
Take care.
Okay.